Hi, my name is Doug Scalapino. Came to UCSB in 68, and I've been here ever since. I want to tell you a little more about superconductivity. My title, as I looked at, was Materials and Mr. Squid. But I wanted to pause for just a minute and go back to some of the things, one of the things that Laura showed you in her beautiful talk. And it's rotating there, but I want to come over here and start with something that I hope you can see at a distance, but I'll tell you what it is. It's a galvanometer, and it's a large amount of copper wire here at room temperature. And I've got a magnet, and I'd very much like to levitate this magnet above the copper. So I'd very much like to take this magnet, put it down over here, and now if you watch real carefully on that galvanometer, you'll see that there is some current that flows in the copper wire. And I'm sorry, I should lift this up, but I'm not sure I can with one hand. So here we go. Here goes the magnet. I bring it over here, and you can see the galvanometer move. Why? Well, what? It's Faraday's law. I brought a magnet over. I pushed some magnetic flux through the loop. That's caused some current to run, and you can see that it's running through there. There it is. But you can also see that in a very short time, a second, half a second, that current has stopped running. It stopped running because that wire has resistance. Now, if I come up to what you're looking down on here, styrofoam that I went over and found yesterday in our shop, piece of copper block they cut me, and then on top of it I've just laid this superconductor material. This is called YBCO. If afterwards you come up and look at it, I'll show you more about it. It's a rather nondescript piece of ceramic, not something that I would have thought would have been a great superconductor, which is why many people didn't discover it before Bednords and Mueller looked at it. Nevertheless, what you see on top of that is something that I need a tweezers for because it's gotten cold. What you see on top of it is a magnet. So this is one of these very strong magnets, cobalt samarium magnet maybe. It's the kind of magnet that's made a lot of things operate in your car since it was discovered. And as I bring it over and put it on this, it's levitating. You see it more from where you're looking at it as it's rocking back and forth. But if you could get over and look at it, you'd see that it's, I don't know, an eighth of an inch, 16th of an inch off that. Why is that? Well, as Laura said, it's because when I put it down, just as when I put the magnet into that copper loop, a current was generated. That current created a field that lifted the magnet. Over here, though, the current stopped. Magnet wouldn't stay levitated. Long as I keep this cold, that current will run, magnet will levitate. Now you might say, well, what is superconductivity? What does that really mean? What it really means is you go into the lab, you get a ring like this, you launch a current into it, and then you come back in a week and you measure it. You measure the magnetic field or whatever aspect you can probe of it, and you find it hasn't changed. And then after a year, you come back. You find out, is it changing? And the answer is, depending on how you make your system, and if you make your superconductor wire rather thin in spots, you may find that it gradually decays. And then as you make it thicker, you try and estimate, how long would this current run if it were thick? And your estimates begin to run out until you get to numbers that are the age of the universe. And then you say, that is superconductivity, that current will run in that state. That's superconductivity. What will happen is as the nitrogen evaporates, the copper block will cool, this will fall down. Okay? It'll set there because the material will be normal, it will become resistive. Now you come to the next and perhaps most important aspect of superconductivity. When that happens, I'll try and bring it back over. And I'll leave the magnet on top, just where it is. It'll just be sitting there. And now I'll pour in the liquid nitrogen, and that magnet will lift back up. And now you say, how could that happen? On account of this time, I didn't bring some flux in. I didn't create some current. What in fact happened was that black blob of YBCO doesn't like magnetic fields in it, and it spontaneously created a current that flowed in it so as to block the magnetic field of that magnet I've laid on it. That's called the Meissner effect, and that's the real aspect of superconductivity and shows us what is so incredibly special about this system when it goes superconducting. So now, let me leave this. We'll go look some of it later, and let me go on with what I was going to say. And you should come up afterwards and look at this system if you would like. Now, I guess I can't resist this as long as we're still on this. That was a very small piece of YBCO. You'll see it's about the size of the new dollar coin. When I was at a Houston meeting, you could walk in, and you could walk in and stand on a much bigger piece of YBCO and be levitated. And I did. But here's a picture of a gentleman now. Let's see. Just 1 second. We'll figure this out. This is a picture of a fairly large gentleman who I will show you a close-up of this region in the next view graph. And I hope I will. That is unbelievable. All right. I'll not only show you a close-up, I'll show you what happened in a nice journal article we have. I have a close-up of his feet. I evidently have managed to leave it somewhere. I'm sorry, I found it. Then I will tell you what happened in the Physics Today journal. Okay, here's the close-up I was looking for. Oh, come on. There, I think you can see that he's standing actually on a magnet, and there's a piece of high-TC superconductor. And I hope you can see that he is indeed levitated. Now, what happened? We have a publication called Physics Today. It goes out to all physicists or anybody, I guess, who will pay for the subscription. And a neighbor of ours in town named Barbara Levy does wonderful articles for them. And there was to be a picture of this like I've shown you. But it was actually of a leading Japanese scientist. And so the caption read, and I forget what, Dr. Yamamoto being levitated on a large YBCO, piece of YBCO. But somehow, by accident, this photograph got put in. Now, this shows how dumb I was. I was desperately looking for this some years ago when I was to give some talk. And I wasn't interested the evening I was so desperate in reading any figure captions. So when I found this picture, I clipped it out, never reading the best part of it, which was underneath an explanation of who it was. And so I don't have it on the view graph, but that's a true story. At any rate, that is superconductivity. Let me say now what I thought that I would talk on. I would tell you a little about the materials, and then I would tell you a little about how is it we measure this macroscopic quantum state you've heard about. And then we're very fortunate that Robin Cantor is here from Los Alamos. He is head of a company that makes a device that we will turn to that is a squid. We'll talk a bit about that at the end. So these are the things I would like to talk about. And let's turn to the materials and see how this works. It was pulled off the web. It may or may not show so well, I will tell you. What this is I asked a friend, Zach Fisk, and then Jim Schilling, how many elements are now superconducting? If you just take the elemental elements, like lead or aluminum or mercury, how many? And I'll go on to show you, but my recollection is there are 29 if you don't put them under pressure. If you put them on pressure, there are maybe 20 others. And so what are colored in is almost everything that's colored or half, some that are half shaded are only under pressure. But what would we make of this? Well, I think that on one of the view graphs he sent me, which didn't reproduce well enough, there's writing by a man named Bernd Matthias. Bernd Matthias was kind of the leader for many, many years in the hunt for new materials. And scribbled across the top of a periodic table like I showed you was this: almost everything is superconducting. There are 29 naturally occurring elements, 20 more under pressure. Carbon-60, which are these buckyballs, if you can dope them, they go superconducting. And it used to be not listed as an element that would go superconducting. But we heard at our conference very recently, thanks, we heard at our conference very recently that it was possible to push enough electrons into a layer of buckyballs that you could make the C60 go superconducting. Now, it used to be when I was asked what was the highest transition temperature of the natural elements, I would say niobium at 9.5. But that was before people took sulfur, put it under about a million atmospheres of pressure, and they found that elementary sulfur would go superconducting at 17 Kelvin. The bottom line, and it's perhaps not all that interesting, except to say how many things people have looked for. There are about 2,000 compounds that physicists and chemists have made trying to understand what might be better superconductors and what were they looking for. Okay, here's what they were looking for. Here's what drove them. Over the years, the TC was rising very slowly. A man named Bill Little and I were once asked to extrapolate from the Navy when we would have a superconductor at, I don't know, 25 or 30 Kelvin. And I remember we did make a plot like this, which isn't very scientific. It's just number of years versus transition temperatures. But you can see there's kind of a straight line going out there. And so we extrapolated out, and I forgot whether it was 2005 or 2010 that we would finally get up to 25 Kelvin. But of course, that's not the way science works. Science works by discovery. Science works by people trying something that nobody else thought made much sense. And that's what Bednords and Mueller did. They looked at this material that you can come and see here, which is a ceramic, which has many elements in it. And all at once, they found in 1986, they began publishing, there was this dramatic increase. Then Paul Chu at University of Houston and Wu found the magic that YBCO could, which I will show you, this yttrium, barium, copper, oxygen mixture, could go at temperatures of around 90 Kelvin.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Please.
What was the insight that you let them just start thinking about
Good. Okay, so let's go through that. That's as interesting as any of the rest of the talk, and maybe more interesting. Mueller had been a man who had done a great deal of work in what's called the Jahn-Teller effect. This was a notion that, in a material that I'll show you shortly, that there could be extremely strong electron-phonon interactions, extremely strong matrix effects in this material. And so he thought this material would be particularly well adapted to do what Laura told you, to bind the electrons. And so he went after this because he believed that that was a dominant and unusually strong interaction in this material. Now, what's happened? What's happened since 86 is, I believe, almost all theorists in the world believe that has absolutely nothing to do with why this material goes superconducting. Now, to be quite honest, Mueller himself still gives talks, and he believes the Jan Teller effect that he was driven to look at this is why this is going on. And so he's the man who found it. You might say, well, he's the man who's going to be right. But I don't think so. I think when the story ends, he made the discovery, but he made it for reasons that have nothing to do with why it goes superconducting. I don't know if any of my colleagues want to comment on that, but we can comment more. That's what I believe. Now, let's go on, though, a little bit about the magic of the materials. What's finally happened is, under pressure, Paul Chew drove this thing up to 160, 164. The goal was, of course, room temperature or higher. And so Paul Chew, and I told him, I'm giving this talk, I'm desperate, please send me something. He sent me a bunch of cartoons, and it was very nice of him, and he sent me other good things. Thank you, Paul. And he sent me this, though, which was wonderful. Announcing the first superconductor that works at room temperature. This is October 1983, and it is a conductor, Kim Allen Klug, and he is one superconductor. I will tell Paul it was the best part of the talk, at any rate. What do these materials look like? I'll try and show you a model in a minute, but let me show you a picture of the material that Paul found. Paul won the National Medal of Science, among other things, for this marvelous discovery. And what you see here, and we will show in a model much better later, on the right, are some red planes. Those red planes contain copper and oxygen. The blue materials in between contain various of the yttrium and the barium and some copper oxygen chains. And most of us think that the action of this superconductor takes place in these copper oxygen layers, and that the rest of the structure is built to hold the layers properly and to dope them, to provide electrons or carriers, actually to remove some carriers from them so they can become superconducting. But let's look at the material, because I think it's another aspect of this subject that I think would interest students, and one would find, I think, it was quite beautiful. And so now I can work this. I'll show you a model and talk a little, just a little bit about it. So here's one of these models made of balls and sticks, and perhaps, yeah, I don't know. Let's see. Yeah, we'll just have to go with this. So, what's happening in this model? What's happening in this model is there are various layers in this, and these are the layers which I will show you by holding it for a minute and then put it up. These layers are sheets that come out at you. And the sheets contain copper, which are these yellow balls, and between them are oxygens. And it's this sheet that I have my hand on here that is said to be the main layer. But it's a beautiful material because there are two sheets very close together, and there's some spacing, and then there are two more sheets. It's a beautiful and complex structure that you might want to look at. It is also something that shows us a feature of what Laura talked about. This crystal has long-range order. We'll talk more now about order. But what long-range order means is, if you know what one unit cell, again, to say some of the words going on here, this distance is about 4 angstroms. It's around 3.88 angstrom. So we're down looking at the atomic structure of this. If I know that there's a copper here, an oxygen, a copper, and I know the local arrangement of this cell, then I can tell you, if this is a perfect crystal, I can go out here a centimeter, and I can tell you exactly where everything is. That's long-range order in position. And that's easier, I think, for me to understand, certainly, I think, for all of us, because we sit in a room, which if we had the chairs perfectly arranged, this room has long-range order of position here, it has a grain boundary here, and it has long-range order over here, but we have a sense of that. And what's tricky, or interesting and exciting, about the superconducting state is that it has another kind of long-range order, as Laura told you, and I want to talk about that. So let's lay this over. And so the situation here is, this is saying to us, what is superconductivity and who is Mr. Squid? So I'm now back on to the plan of my talk. Superconductivity is this macroscopic quantum state, and we say we have long-range order of the center of mass pair phase. And again, Laura told you about this. I want to tell you about it again. It's what you saw ultimately giving us superconductivity. Now, what is it? What is this? Well, I went over this morning and got a gift that came in the mail, and for the first time put some batteries in it. It's a laser. Basically, this laser that I'm holding is capable of, with the batteries that are in it, feeding light out. But what's so very special about the light is the light has long-range phase order, so that the light that comes out is, first of all, this intense beam you see here. All of the photons have gone into this same state. They could have gone into other states slightly phase shifted, and the waves could just interfere. But if they all have the same phase, they add up. And this beast that I'm holding here has long-range phase order in the photon field. The superconductor has the same thing, but with particles. Let's see why we didn't get that. So, what, in the early days of the last century, physicists began to realize that there might be this notion of wave-particle duality, and that we might be very careful how we describe electrons, or photons and electromagnetism, for that matter. But let's stay with the electron. Electrons, which people thought of as particles, could also have wave properties. And that's the striking thing that superconductivity is showing us. It's showing us on a macroscopic scale that this is the way matter is. And you can say, well, why is matter that way? That's yet a deeper question. I don't know why matter is that way. But what first got me interested in physics, when I was a chemical engineer at Yale, I got 2 years of that in, but the second year I took a little physics, and I began talking about waves and particles that could be waves, and that's when I realized I wanted to try and understand that. Now, 1923 comes along, and Count de Broglie has this insight. And again, where do new things come from? New things come from people who have new thoughts. And de Broglie was certainly enmeshed in a time when sets of questions were raised, people were wondering how to explain a number of phenomena, but ultimately how he came upon this marvelous idea, I don't know. But he eventually came upon a notion, based somewhat on relativity and what he knew about light, that particles, which had a momentum, p equals mv, and were just particles, they also somehow could behave as waves. And the waves would have a wavelength that was Planck's constant early introduced by Planck to explain black body radiation. And that wavelength should go as h over p. And that somehow there should be this wave property of matter. Now, if you look at the date, it's interesting. Because superconductivity is discovered in 1911. So you might imagine after Kamerlin Onnes finds it, people want to try and understand. How do you explain the phenomena? Well, you have a curious situation. I don't think you're going to explain that phenomena in 1912, 1913, 1914. Because you don't have the basic theory. You don't have the basic idea that's yet to come of how you might do this. And it comes, though, fortunately, fairly rapidly. And Schrödinger in 1926, at the urging of Debye, Schrödinger is said to have gone into a seminar to talk about Debye's work that particles were waves. And Debye, who was more or less the head physicist there at the time, said, "You don't come into my seminar and tell me about waves unless you have a wave equation." And so Schrödinger is said to have gone off and decided, well, if he really were going to have this de Broglie wave, he would write some type of wave equation down. He indeed wrote this down in 1926, began calculating with it, and showed that you could begin to explain the properties of the basic atomic systems, hydrogen in particular, and that you found very special waves and shapes. This happens to be called S, this is P, this is D. These are various ways that the electron surrounds the atom in the wave it takes. The waves we're going to talk about are more extended plane waves that have to do with center of mass motion. But this will come back and will come into John Kirtley's talk as well. At any rate, the idea of the wave properties of matter at quite a time later. Okay? You have Kamerlin Onnes finding superconductivity in 1911. You have Schrödinger writing down his quantum mechanical wave equation in 26. And then you have a long period, in some ways, until 57, when Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer put forth this notion that is the theory of superconductivity as we knew it then. As David and others have said, with the new material coming, there is a question as to whether there may be a new theory. But this theory is the one I will tell you about. It's the theory that explains at least the phenomena we always knew in the low temperature ones. Now, what's special about this? Well, I'll first say what's unique. You can read it on here, but then we'll talk about why. So what's unique about the superconductor is that, well, there's this macroscopic number of electrons which somehow combine into this one quantum state, this one wave. And they have the same center of mass momentum, so they have the same wavelength, and they have the same phase. Okay? Now, that's going to give us lots of different properties, but how's that possible? Some of you are well aware that when I turned on that laser, I was dealing with light, and that light particles are called bosons, and that bosons have the property that you can put multiple bosons into the same state. While electrons are said by the Pauli principle that nature allows you only to put one electron into each state. Now, if these are orbital states, you can put one electron spin up and one electron spin down, but you can't put more. So how is it, we tell you, all of these electrons have condensed into this very special quantum state, so many of them that we can reach out and feel them, we can build devices, that they live on a macroscopic scale. And the situation is that with the electrons pairing, you now had a situation that the pair behaved like a boson. The situation in quantum mechanical wave functions is that if you interchange two bosons, the wave function remains symmetric. If you interchange two fermions, it changes its sign. The characteristic here was that the electrons, because they were pairs, if you thought of interchanging the pairs, you had two of them, you could make it go, you could condense them, and you could put them all into a state that had this property. Now, would you want to do that? Well, if this were my superconductor, or if this were colder, here, I'll grab one. You can see it's cracking already. If this were my superconductor, which indeed it is, it's at room temperature, you might say, well, you probably don't put them all in that state because you're not carrying any current. Basically, I'd put them in a low state with zero momentum here, and that would be their low energy state, and they would be fine if I cooled it down. But if I brought up a magnet or tried to put a field in it, it, for reasons we will get to, wants to exclude the field. It then could run currents, or I could start a current in it, and then I would, in a sense, have these objects all flowing, all with the same momentum, and they would simply move along, and that would be the supercurrent. And now you might say, but why don't they stop? Okay. Well, they don't stop for much the same reason that the crystal structure I showed you doesn't get messed up until you heat it a lot. You have a perfect crystal, and you begin heating it a bit. And now individual atoms may move off their sites into interstitial positions. But to melt the solid and destroy the long-range order, you have to put in long rifts that break the order called domain walls. You have to have these rifts forming throughout it to finally drive it in the liquid state. That's energetically very costly. And so once these things establish their long-range order, in the solid, it was position order. In the superconductor, it's this phase order. You can knock a few out, but the remaining ones, remember, when the others condense, they condense back into it. And this is like the wheels that Laura Green showed you, that you had multiple wheels tracking the road. You knock one wheel off, but the others keep the course. It's too energetically costly in this system to have them change unless they all change. And for them to all change is too low a probability. And that's why these currents run and run and run. Now, let's see if I can show you a little bit more about how some of this works as we head towards Mr. Squid. Here's another picture that I'd like just to have because yesterday I got a hold of a plastic tube. And Matthew Fisher and I took this long plastic tube and we put a red ribbon down it. And the red ribbon was to be where the phase of the wave was. And then I would take this long object and twist it to show you what I'm about to show you. But unfortunately, I went over and got far too stiff a tube, and I couldn't twist it. Now, you might say, what is that? That's a really good superconductor with a strong phase stiffness. That would be a heck of a material if we could make it and it were really a superconductor. So this morning I got up, cut a piece of cable apart, and took took some coat hanger wires, and now I made a bit of a superconducting ring that I would like to talk to you about. And I would like you to think of these clothespins as the phase of the wave as I go around this loop. And I hope you can see roughly this loop is in perfect phase. Every clothespin is pointing up. As we do things to it, we want to watch what happens to the phase. And that was a picture, as I say, that was to go with the plastic tube that would have been nice if I could have twisted it. Now, why do I bother you with this? I bother you with this because while I hope you take away from the Meissner experiment, from the levitating experiment, the fact that we could have persistent current, I want to go down into more detail now, telling you how is it that I know that a piece of superconductor as large as this, if only I had one, would have phase coherence and be in this single quantum state all the way around this loop over what? A macroscopic distance, over a distance of, I don't know, what if this is straightened out 3 feet? Okay? How do I know that? We know that because we're going to play with this phase. We're going to twist this. There are various ways of twisting this phase. But because these particles are charged, it turns out that if you were to take a loop of superconductor, so you were to take the little chip I just showed you and cut a hole in it, so there's a loop of superconductor, and you were to turn on a magnetic and put it through it, that you would put a flux through it, which is just the magnetic field times the area of my loop. Now, if you did that, quantum mechanics tells us that you would be changing the phase. So, if a magnetic flux threads this ring, the phase of this pair wave function gets twisted. And it gets twisted by an amount that depends how much flux you put. This is B times A. So, depending on how much magnetic field I put through, it twists it a certain amount. And the unit by which you measure how much of a twist you get is the so-called flux quanta. It's quite remarkable. It's Planck's constant, velocity of light, the charge of the electron. It's around 2 times 10 to the minus 7 Gauss. What, to remind you, the Earth's field is about a half a Gauss. So this is a very small field I'm telling you about. If you were to put this through a loop, you would twist its phase. Now, what's the problem with this? Well, maybe we can see it here if this all works. I'll start putting a magnetic field through this. And it begins to twist the phase. Now, this is the same problem I had before, but we will start to get it. Need more hands. It begins to twist the phase. And now as it twists it more and more, everything would be fine, except can you see where they've come back together, where I cut the wire? The phases aren't matching. One is down, one is up. That's not good. That's going to cost it energy. And so what it really has to do is twist it at least this far. Can you see I've made it up now? These two? Those are up at you. The rest of the guys are twisting the best they can. What I needed was surgical tubing. This would be easy and it would have worked beautifully, but I didn't have access to it this morning. It's come around. It's come around by 2 pi. This particular phase has twisted all the way from up to pi all the way around. This phase has made it all the way around, and that would be fine. That would mean this change of phase around the loop was 2 pi, and here I let it be 2 pi n. I just did one twist for you. You could imagine if I really had control of this, I could have twisted and twisted and twisted. What that tells you, if you solve this simple equation, is that you will find that the only allowed flux through this loop, if you want to maintain this phase decently so it comes back to itself, is some multiple of this flux unit. That's the quantization of flux, and it comes about because of the long-range order. Now, you can well imagine that if I were to take this same loop and I were to break it at some point, cut it, open it, it wouldn't care. I could have any flux in there. But because it's closed, I have this quantization of flux. Now, we're going to talk about where that takes us, but let's just go back to our friend the Meissner effect. You saw I had to work to twist this thing. It's stiff. It has some phase stiffness. So does the real material. and therefore the real material would have much preferred not to have any flux come through it, or you might say, one unit of flux or two, then, but that's not quite fair. As I put more flux, it twists. The fact that it would have preferred not to twist here and be right side up, if I could get it back again, is in a sense the Meissner effect that we showed. It wants to exclude flux. It doesn't want it in here. And so it will do some special things to avoid that. Nevertheless, if it's weak in spots or in others, you can get it in. It can at least satisfy that it can handle certain units of flux. Let's talk a little bit more about how that takes us towards seeing this effect and the fact that we had this long-range order. So let's talk for just a minute about this. This unit of flux, I said, was very small. If I had a 1 centimeter loop, and if now I have weak links in the loop, which we'll talk about, which allow me to twist and let it slip in various spots, how small a unit of this flux change can I measure? In fact, I should be careful. How do I measure it? I tell you, it doesn't like this to happen. Well, it doesn't like it to happen, so it perhaps circulates a current in some way, and I pick that up and I see how it stops it. If I can measure this sort of small change that I'm after to what? One part, what did I choose here? 1%, one part in 100. All at once, I have the potential of seeing magnetic fields that are around what? A billionth of the Earth's field. Extremely weak magnetic fields. Now, what Robin Cantor will tell us about in a bit is a technique using superconductivity, using the long-range order that I described, that picks up weak signals like this. Biomagnetic fields are unnatural, particularly brain. One would love to be able to go in cases of what? Focal epilepsy, where you may want to go in and operate and stop some neurons from inadvertently getting into a firing pattern that causes epileptic seizures. You would like to what? Eliminate those, but you would not like to eliminate others. You would therefore like a very good map of where that is, and you would like to find that map without having to surgically go in. They now make helmets. Liquid nitrogen type helmets or temperatures operating there that have, I think, 300 sensors in them that then map what are the signals from the brain that are coming out at just about that level. The heart will put the signal out at about 100 times that level, and there are cardio systems where superconductivity is used, and both Robin and probably Paul Grant will tell us more about that. That make use of this special type of long-range order. So now, let's finally get to Mr. Squid. Squid was a name coined by the late Jim Zimmerman, who passed away about a year ago. Jim built devices, was a co-inventor of the RF Squid, and it stands for Superconducting Quantum Interference Device. The idea, once again, is we're used to lasers and light, where we use these very often to see interference and study how waves interfere. What we've said here, again, is the realization that in nature, electrons have wave properties. In superconductors, there are a macroscopic number of the electrons participating in this wave, so it is a big enough, intense enough wave that we can get our hands on it, manipulate it, use it. It's used here in a way that I will now show you. So this is a picture, a schematic of something called Mr. Squid. Let me just try and say how it works. Mr. Squid has a superconducting wire attached on one end, another wire on the other, and it has this loop I spoke about. Okay? Now what happens is in this loop there are a couple of regions that are greatly weakened. If I had a scissors and had thought more about it, I would weaken a few areas here. But you can imagine, if I cut the rubber and weaken it slightly, it can bend much more easily and could even snap, flip around, and come back in phase. So there are phase slip regions. They simply do it in various ways. They can cut down the material so it's a very thin piece of superconductor. When they run current through this, half of it, if it's symmetric, goes this way. The other half goes here. It comes out. And no voltage is required. It's superconducting. But if they exceed the critical current that this can carry, then the only way it can carry it is to go normal. The normal electrons carry it, and a voltage appears. That's read off with this signal. Now imagine exactly the same situation, except this ring has now trapped a small amount of flux. So here is a small amount of flux in the ring. And now suppose this flux wasn't quite a flux, wasn't quite able to twist the ring to make the phases match. Then what will happen is a spontaneous Meissner-like current will flow in here to make it come back and fit. It always wants to get the twist right. That's its greatest desire with the long-range order it has. That's the lowest energy state it can have. And so in that case, it runs spontaneous currents in here, just like the currents I showed you that levitated the magnet. Now we come and we drive current through it. Well, that current adds on to the current flowing through here, subtracts from the current flowing through here, and pretty soon, you break this junction down. It's carrying too much current. And so now, rather than breaking down out here, it breaks down sooner. You might say, well, it breaks down sooner, but this guy is in great shape. Not so. Once this poor devil breaks down, it forces all the supercurrent to go up through it and completely guts this one. And so at a lower voltage, it switches back, and you see these characteristics, and you very carefully monitor here, and that tells you the flux that you see here and allows you to read right now brain signals. It allows you to use these detectors in a whole host of ways. And we're now at a point where I'd like to introduce you to Robin Cantor. And Robin is going to tell us more about Mr. Squid that he's brought. Robin got his degree working with a man named Alan Goldman at the University of Minnesota. He was then at a company called Conductus that developed squid technology, high TC technology to make squids, and now runs his own company, Star Cryoelectronics, in Los Alamos. And Robin, thank you for coming, and I leave it for you.